Last Thursday at Vicar Street, the cream of Irish music was on show at the RTE Choice Album of the Year Awards. In another stellar year for Irish music across all genres, the choice of the judging panel was announced as For Those I Love, the self-titled debut album from the artist known as For Those I Love. And the man behind that name is David Balfe, who I'm delighted to be talking to this evening. Congratulations, first of all, David. I mean, this is such a personal album for you. I guess winning an award is always good, but there must be an extra layer given the themes and the story behind the album.
Yeah, you're right. I think it might make it feel a little bit more complicated to receive that kind of praise, and certainly a bit more complicated to receive a piece of silverware to hold it. It's simultaneously, you know, a reminder of the, you know, the tragedy that inspired the record, but also, you know, maybe also a reminder of the survival for myself and my friends and my family. So yeah, it's complicated, but it's beautiful.
Yeah, kind of a double-edged sword in some ways, inspired by your friend Paul Curran, who died in 2018. That was, and you've said this yourself, I think, David, in the past, it's such a Dublin-centric record. I mean, it has the sound of Dublin, the feel of Dublin all over it. Were you surprised at how that transferred into, you know, a much broader type of admiration for the work?
Yeah, maybe at first I was pretty surprised by it, especially for, you know, a record that's so colloquial, that has such specific geographical references. But I think I realised, particularly after I played one or two shows outside of Ireland, that the commonality of grief is so universal, and people weren't responding to this record because I was talking about a pub in Coolock or a pub in town. They were responding to a record because of the unifying, you know, the unifying theme of grief, survival, and love that's at the heart of it. And in that way, maybe, yeah, I understood it a lot.
I think there was a specific gig in Glasgow, in fact, where guys came up to you and really associated and really empathised with the situation of you having lost your friend. They seemed to understand it.
It's the very first show I ever played. I mean, I've only played a handful of shows in general. The very first show I ever played was in Glasgow, so it was really, you know, it was really a whole new experience for me in many ways. But after the show, and after all of my shows so far, I've tried to spend time with, you know, with the crowd afterwards. People seem to really want to speak openly about their own experiences with grief and what the record has brought to them. And at Glasgow, it was, you know, it was dominantly a lot of older, like pretty hardy men that were coming up and opening up about their own tragedies. Some had, you know, lost family. One guy had lost his son. All of these different horrors that had happened to them, but they were coming to that music with their own grief, and they were pulling something from it, and they were all leaving lighter than they came in. There's nothing that could be more beautiful to me than that, and that really goes a long way to offset any of the guilt or the more complicated feelings that I do have about the record.
And I know initially, at any rate, you weren't 100% sure about the whole idea of performing live, and this record was initially made really for family and friends. It wasn't made for public consumption. What changed your mind around that? That first of all, that the record should be more public, and then that, yeah, I should get up on a stage and share these thoughts with people?
Great question, because it was family and friends that were the reason behind that too. They were the ones that I spoke to when a label first showed interest. They were the ones that encouraged me. They were the ones that that wanted to see this record have a new world and have a new set of listeners, because I think they drew something from it and they were convinced that other people could too. Likewise, with the live performances, they were the ones that were encouraging me to walk down that road in the first place, not just for what it could do for other people, but to be pretty frank, I think my friends just wanted to be able to hear those songs in a massive you know, on a massive sound system as well. And that's where all of that drive came from, and that's where it still comes from, if I'm honest.
And you know, you've spoken a lot there, David, I mean, about what these songs and this record has done for other people, and how friends have said, I want to hear that music, I want to hear it up on a big system. What does it do for you, you know, performing it live, getting this award, getting the record out there? What has that done for you?
It has done an awful lot, but it changes very frequently. You know, as I said, I've only played a handful of shows, so I still don't even know how live music as a whole is something that affects me. And some days I've come off the stage and I've felt I'm still carrying the weight of the world. I've come off and I've felt more weight, I've felt more grief. And then other days I just get on the stage and I feel it's the most life-affirming moment that I'd had in my memory up until then. And every bit of weight that had been, you know, burdening me is suddenly lifted. And you see the joy and the impact that it has on strangers. And it changes everything. So it's something that's very, very much evolving for me. It's why I feel so difficult to commit to the idea that this is something that I always want to do. Or I just know that, right now it's helping me grow a lot as a person. And that's the best I can hope for.
I'm sure I speak for a lot of people when I say that I hope it continues to be affirmative and an affirming thing for you, and that it continues to give you that growth. I'm looking forward to see what happens next and what winning the Choice Prize, how that will move the music along into maybe new places, new discoveries and new thoughts and emotions. Lovely to speak with you this evening, David. Congratulations. Lead us into I Have a Love.
Sure. This song is I Have a Love. It's the first track off my album, and it's a song about my best mate, Paul Curran, who... I just wanted to say you guys gave a platform to back in the day, and me and my friends are still very grateful that you guys did that for him and played his work. So this song is about him.
Thanks, David.
I have a love and it never fades.
There we go. I Have a Love, the title of that track, and that from the self-titled debut album, For Those I Love, the winner of the RTE Choice Album of the Year. Tashi Bjogna Kyahru, Trish Ashokht, are on Iha Luan Shaw. In May 1882, one of the most seismic events in 19th century British-Irish history took place. The Phoenix Park Murders, as they were known, saw the assassination of two top British officials, the Chief Secretary of Ireland, Lord Frederick Cavendish, and his Undersecretary, Thomas Burke. The subsequent investigation, trial and executions saw a witness protected under an early version of a witness protection programme, and a bizarre coincidence which led to his own demise as he fled Ireland for South Africa. These events are portrayed in a new documentary docudrama called The Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell, which will be aired on TG Cahir on Chéadaoin Bheag Seo on Sheoláid Déag de Mhíle Márta agus an Stiúrthóir Thomas Seoga Lomanacht. Fáilte rót an Clár Tomás, lovely to have you here with us. This story that is in this particular docudrama of yours, The Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell, we've often heard the saying, truth is stranger than fiction. Never was there a statement that applied correctly to a story than to this one. It's so unusual.
It is indeed. There's an awful lot happening with this story. And as you said, truth is stranger than fiction. And I think if you try to pitch this story as a fiction piece, you might not get very far with it, because there's so much happening, so many strange events happened. And I hope it's made a very interesting film that people will be really interested to watch.
Well, I suppose part of the reason that you couldn't have it just as a fiction or just as a documentary, certainly just as a fiction, is that the starting point for this is what were called the Phoenix Park murders in May 1882. Mm-hmm. I referred to them in the introduction as a seismic event there. In the documentary itself, those assassinations are compared to, you know, in modern day parlance, to something like the assassination of JFK. Just tell us what happened in the Phoenix Park on that day and remind us of in May 1882.
Yeah, you have to think of the time, the context of the time. It was quite a febrile time in Ireland, the land league, land wars. There was a lot of struggles going on between the normal people of Ireland and the British Empire rule. As concerns the Phoenix Park murders, there was a subgroup within the Fenian movement at the time called the Invincibles. And their main and sole aim was to take out tyrants, as they called them, the highest ranking officials in the British Empire in Ireland. And this day they had targeted Thomas Henry Burke, who was a man from Tuam in County Galway, who was working in Dublin Castle, the third most powerful person in Ireland at the time. And he'd just by chance met the brand new permanent undersecretary, Lord Cavendish, who had literally just arrived in Ireland and had been sworn in that day. They were strolling through the Phoenix Park, and this gang, the Invincibles, this subgroup of the Fenians, targeting Henry Burke, went to assassinate him, and because Cavendish was with him, assassinated him as well, and therefore had taken out the second and third most powerful people in the British Empire in Ireland at the time. And as you can imagine from that, as you said, it was like a JFK moment at the time. It was huge, and it rocked the whole British Empire and therefore the world.
And not only that, the murders in and of themselves, just the act of murder in and of itself, obviously shocking, but the nature of those two murders. This wasn't where guys walked up with guns and shot a guy at point blank range. They were killed with knives.
Yeah, it was vicious. It was absolutely vicious. There were 12-inch surgical knives that had been brought in from London. They wanted to send a message. They wanted to show that the British government could be reached and they could do it in the most vicious and brutal way. And we don't pull back from that in the film because it was such a part of it. The brutality of it was so stark that we felt we had to show it as it happened. And because of the nature of the killings, it really shook the British Empire. People like Queen Victoria, Gladstone, they were all commenting. The Queen Victoria had several entries in her own personal diaries about it.
Let's listen to a clip then. What we get in the film, essentially, Tomás, is a number of talking heads, but then these dramatised sections. And this is just a little bit ahead of the murder, in fact. Mm-hmm. The character here called James Carey, played by Stephen Jones, he's in a barn with another group from the gang. This is just as the Invincibles are being formed. So let's have a listen.
The orders come through from the top, boys.
Are we to go ahead with it?
About time, if you ask me.
And when did they want us to start?
As soon as we can.
What does the letter say exactly?
Remove all tyrants from the country. Any government official is a legitimate target.
What do we call ourselves?
We don't call ourselves anything.
What about the Invincibles?
Well, if we're to call ourselves something, that's not a bad idea, Tim.
There you go. James Carey, played there by Stephen Jones, in a scene from The Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell. And Tomás Shoiga, director and writer of the film, is with me this evening. You get a real sense of, you know, particularly in the part of Carey there, these were men who knew what they wanted to do and they were prepared to do anything to further the Irish cause, essentially. But Carey is a very, very complicated character, not least because of one Detective Mallon, who is another quite a rum chap as well.
Very much so, and James Carey, along with Patrick O'Donnell, is one of the linchpins of the film. As you said, a very interesting character, had been involved in the Fenian movement since the 1860s, very high ranking, one of the burgeoning middle class, I suppose, to an extent, who was coming through in the major cities in Ireland, who were very much involved with the Fenian movement. He was a house builder, contractor, married with 7 children, but massively involved in the Fenian movement and at the head of this gang of Invincibles. And then obviously when this happened in the Phoenix Park, Superintendent John Mallon, a member of the Metropolitan Police, was brought in to basically find out who these people were. And he had many contacts in that world, and it wasn't too long till he started finding that James Carey was probably involved. He probably knew James Carey from the many years of Fenian activity, and he started bringing in Fenian members left, right and centre to question them.
I love the way you say there, Tomás, that he decided to find out. Malin had methods of finding out, and it wasn't always, you know, you think, all right, so they beat the guys up until they got them, the information out of them. It was much more insidious than that. Let's listen to a clip where Owen McDiarmid it is who plays the character of Malin, and he's in a prison cell quizzing James Carey, again, Stephen Jones, the actor here.
Haven't you had enough of this place? You could be out there with... What's your wife's name again?
Maggie.
Aye, her. You can leave any time you want. If you give me what I want.
No, Malin.
No matter. But the longer you stay and stay silent, the closer you are to the hanging tree.
That's kind of Malin being a nice guy in some ways.
Yeah, it's one of his nicer moments.
Yeah. We're talking soon about the Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell docudrama or TG Cahar agus Stuart agus Scrivenor and Sconine Lomanokter and Glor Tomás Shoiga. We have to get on to then the piece. We'd go to Gaeltacht Tiochunnel for the next little bit, in fact. This is the bit that you couldn't make up. All along through the film, we're hearing about this guy called Patrick O'Donnell, and we're thinking, what's he got to do with? He wasn't one of the Invincibles. No, he wasn't in there. The meeting between O'Donnell and not James Carey at this stage, a different name at this point in time. Yeah. That's an extraordinary. That's the twist. That's the kind of stranger than fiction, stranger than truth type of thing.
It's true. James Carey, after turning state evidence basically against his brothers in the Fenian group at the Invincibles, he was basically put in a rudimentary form of a witness protection program. His hairstyle was changed, his beard was shaved off. He was sent away from Ireland towards South Africa because he wouldn't be safe in England or in America, definitely not in Ireland. And on the boat, he meets a fella from Donegal called Patrick O'Donnell. And Patrick O'Donnell had a very ordinary life up to this point. He'd, like many people in Ireland, he'd emigrated to America. He'd come back with his family, gone back to America. And at this stage, he's going towards South Africa to work in the diamond mines, trying to make his fortune. They meet on a boat from England to South Africa, and on the way, James Carey, as you say, has now an alias, James Power, and he persuades Patrick O'Donnell to come from Cape Town with him further east towards Durban in Natal, and basically the two of them to start off and make a new life for each other.
Yeah, let's have a listen to the kind of friendship that strikes up between them initially. At any rate, it's Patrick O'Donnell, Owen McGillivray is the actor here, and James Carey is now called James Power, but he's still played by Stephen Jones, and here are the two of them. On reasonably good terms on the ship.
Look who it is.
James Power, me old flower.
Oh, Patrick O'Donnell.
Good devil, yeah.
How are you, Susan?
Very good, and yourself?
Oh, sure, never better. Great. Well, have you made up your mind?
But what?
Don't act hick with me, Patrick. Coming up to Natal, the four of us.
Well, I'd like to have a look around Cape Town first, you know, in the mines. I know a wee bit about that business, but more than your sheep farming up in Natal. I'll let you know tomorrow in Cape Town.
It's hard to get something out of a Donegal man's head when he's got it in there, huh? I'm going to get a drink.
That's the two of them meeting on the ship then on their way to South Africa from the film The Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell. Malin played by Owen McDiarmid, James Carey, or Power as he is there, played by Stephen Jones, and Patrick O'Donnell played by Owen McGillivray. Now, the bat-eared among the audience will have noticed that this film's called The Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell. So there was a case. Patrick O'Donnell was basically, and we're not giving anything away here really, Patrick O'Donnell recognises through a series of events, said, that's not James Power, that's the famous James Carey that everybody in Ireland knew had informed on the Invincibles around those Phoenix Park murders. And there's a shooting incident between the two of them, and Carey stroke Power dies. There's a court case. This is where the twists and turns are just impossible to get your head around in some ways, Tomás.
Yeah, it takes on many turns at this stage. Basically, the problem for people prosecuting the case and defending the case was there were many different versions and many different accounts of what happened on the ship. As you said, Patrick O'Donnell had recognised James Carey through a sketch he'd picked up in Cape Town. He got stuck on the boat between Cape Town and Natal with Carey, and basically at some point Carey thought that something might be going on, asked O'Donnell to meet him, and this is where, as you said, it gets a bit muddy. Nobody knows exactly sure what happened, but everyone knows that Patrick O'Donnell shot and killed James Carey.
And the propaganda value of that for the Republican movement, saying, look, you see, if you're an informant, you're never going to disappear. You're never going to get away with it.
That's exactly it. We can stretch our arm all the way to South Africa. Like, we will find you, which was a huge thing for the Fenian movement against the British Empire at that stage, because if you can't protect your informants, no one's going to inform for you in the future. So we get to the case. He's brought back to England. He's brought to the London, the Old Bailey, and he's on trial. And it's so huge. The defence and prosecution teams are massive. The Attorney General is prosecuting the case for the state, and some of the biggest lawyers of the time are defending Patrick O'Donnell, because about 1.5 million euros worth of funds were raised for his defence. And during the court case, you see all the different versions coming through. The defence saying that Patrick O'Donnell was only defending himself, the state saying that it was willful and premeditated murder. And as you say, the propaganda value at the time was huge.
And I don't want to give too much away, but there's a particular document that only came to light in the last 100 years later, in the 1980s, that is kind of pivotal to the outcome of the trial. And again, for those who don't know the outcome of the trial, let's not spoil it on them.
Of course, but as you say, it's a huge thing. The file was closed for 100 years by order, only through Sean O'Curran, who did all the research and whose book the film is based on, found this in the military archives in Kew in England. And it, as you said, and we don't want to give away too much, but there is a huge issue here about whether or not everything was as it should have been during the court case.
It should have been. Well, Cogorgicus, Agus Gonamahagotas Velling and Ocht Tomás.
Queen Lamarth Sean.
Tomás Shoiga and Shin, and The Queen versus Patrick O'Donnell will be broadcast on Wednesday of next week, March the 16th, night before St. Patrick's Night, 9:30 PM on TG Cahir. Artist Thomas Gainsborough, known as the painter who loved women, is famed for his prowess as a portrait painter. Visitors to the National Gallery will know his painting The Cottage Girl, for example, and his famed Blue Boy, which hangs in the National Gallery in London. Gifted though he may have been, he had to work in the very competitive portraiture market of the mid-1700s. He vied, this is Gainsborough I'm talking about, vied for commissions with the slightly cheaper George Romney, and of course, perhaps the slightly better connected Sir Joshua Reynolds, who was president of the Royal Academy. But in his heart, Gainsborough was a landscape painter. And now, for the first time in Ireland, 25 recently discovered landscape drawings go on display at the National Gallery of Ireland. The exhibition is called Young Gainsborough, Rediscovered Landscape Drawings. Jessica Fahey has been to see them for us, and she's with me in studio this evening. We're going to tweet the images, as we often do when Jess is in talking to us, at RTE Arena, if you want to look at what we're talking about. And we'll start by tweeting straight away The Cottage Girl. Now, this is Gainsborough, Jess, from 1785, so it's much later than the actual material of the exhibition that we're going to talk about. But it's Gainsborough at the height of his powers. So maybe explain what this shows to us about the later Gainsborough and what he became.
Yes. So essentially, by the time we're looking at the later part of his career, this is painted only 3 years before he dies. He's finally kind of found a way to bring together landscape and maybe more of a sort of romantic type of subject. Here, it's not not technically a portrait. The subject is just some young street urchin that he asked to come in and paint. And it is the sort of, in terms of stylistically, it's him having already sort of worked through and achieved the highest standard.
It's interesting that you say that technically it's not a portrait, and that's not just because the person is unidentified, because obviously there are lots of portraits that are of unidentified people.
It's not meant to be one.
Yeah, is it the fact that it is such a pastoral scene? The landscape is very important, while the young girl holding the dog and the urn or the vase is very much in the foreground. There is a lot going on behind her as well.
Yeah, they sort of talk about his later landscapes as being very idealized and sort of representing like a kind of perfect Arcadia. So like an imagined forever golden age of beautiful, idyllic landscape. So by placing this young, unidentified, probably boy in terms of model, but always been known as Cottage Girl, might be a young boy called Jack that he used a couple of times as a model, placing them into this context, they're not meant to be someone today. They're meant to be someone who could have lived at any time.
Yeah, because there's even the holding of the urn or the jug is the kind of a classical feel off that, isn't there?
Yes, exactly.
Briefly then on the rivalry between him and Joshua Reynolds, how big a rivalry was that? And how much of it is down to Blue Boy, a really iconic work of Gainsborough's, with a great story that may or may not be true, unfortunately.
It's such a great story, and the story was first told in 1820, so we've been telling the story for a very long time. So essentially, Reynolds gave a lecture on how artists shouldn't use blue as the main colour in their paintings, because they believe that with aerial perspective, which is to make things further away, look further away in the painting by using colder colours. So that would be distracting if the blue was a cold colour as the main colour of the painting. So apparently then Gainsborough in response painted his Blue Boy. Now, he didn't call it that.
Yeah.
It was later called the Blue Boy, which is a figure dressed entirely in blue. And that painting, as you mentioned, is currently in the National Gallery in London, but actually is only on loan, and it has been in America for the last 100 years. So there's kind of an excitement around seeing it again. But with the fancy picture that we're looking at here, which is what we call the Cottage Girl, we know that Reynolds actually bought one that Gainsborough had painted, which is called Little Girl with Pigs. And Reynolds liked to tell people the story that when Gainsborough was painting it, his studio was full of pigs running around the place, because Gainsborough always had to have the model in front of him. And then final part of their sort of rivalry comes about because the job of court painter goes to Joshua Reynolds, who's also president of the RA, Royal Academy, and Gainsborough was the favourite of George III, so it was really surprising that Reynolds got the job. And then when Gainsborough's on his deathbed, he calls Reynolds to see him and they make up, and then Reynolds gives an extraordinary lecture as one of his discourses in 1789, after Gainsborough's death, saying that he was the best of them.
Typical though for an artist, isn't it? You know, you'll get all the adulation after you die. And probably the financial recompense comes.
Oh no, he had it during his lifetime.
Part of the portraiture, the idea there was, I suppose it was commercially more viable, really, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but surprisingly with the Cottage Girl, that went for more money than a portrait usually would. It was bought by Sir Francis Bassett and he paid way over the odds for it.
So bought as a collector's piece,
exactly,
as opposed to this is a picture
Gainsborough's
of my,
famous at this stage. Yeah.
All right, well, let's get stuck into what's actually on show then as part of this exhibition, because it's a much earlier Gainsborough that we're seeing. How far back? Of 1785 is the Cottage Girl, so we're right back. He's only in his 20s.
So
1740s.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's some of the earliest drawings that we know by him, and it's an extraordinary find, because it was just one researcher, a woman called Lindsay Staten, who was looking through essentially a bound album that on the front of it said drawings by Edwin Landseer, who was a real favourite of Queen Victoria, and someone on her behalf had purchased this book after he died in about 1874, so into the 19th century. And when she was looking at this in the 1990s, she thought, that doesn't look like the style at all
of
Landseer. So she, about 12 years later, in 2013, was looking at a painting by Gainsborough and thought, hang on a second, that looks exactly like those drawings I looked at before, and put the two things together. So now we've 25 early drawings by Gainsborough that we didn't know we had before.
Right, let's tweet one of those right now. And this is Wooded Landscape, Silver Birch. First of all, it really is. It's a treescape, if you like, that we have here, Jess. And there's Looks like, yes, it is a stream coming down the middle. What's the medium here? It's quite a cloudy type of feel off it, isn't there?
Yep. So at this stage in his career, he's only using black and white chalk on coloured paper. And there's a few different types of paper he used. But mostly he used a really, really cheap paper from France that was usually used for wrapping things. So it wasn't even an expensive paper. Mm. And again, that's early career, so not surprising. Later in his career, he'll use watercolour and he uses gouache and he even varnishes some of his drawings. So we do know that these are early. At this stage, and this is how the exhibition is organised. So at this stage, he's going outside to make studies where he'll look at an individual tree and maybe spend a lot of time drawing it. Or he's working at home using a weird set of models, which could include using broccoli to stand in for trees and lighting it with a candle and having mirrors for water. So he's using a few different techniques.
How common was that type of thing?
Not really.
Because he's kind of making a still life out of a landscape, isn't he?
Absolutely. And he made little wooden figurines that he would place within it as well. Yeah. It feels like someone playing with a sort of toy train set. You know.
So if you do want to follow the images that were tweeting, or the word Jess is speaking to us about this evening at RTE Arena. So we've just been looking at Gainsborough wooded landscape. Let's move on to another drawing, and this is trees beside an ascending path. He's very fond of the trees. So is this basically, as you say, they were studies? Is he effectively trying to work his way into landscape painting? That was his great heartfelt desire.
Absolutely. So he seems to have wanted to do that all his career. Even in the 1760s, he wrote to a friend saying that he was sick of painting portraits, that he just wanted to paint landscapes. He also wasn't too fond of the patrons of his portraits as well. That was a bit of an issue for him. But with the landscapes, he grew up in Sudbury in Surrey, and he just adored the countryside. And we have, you know, quotes from people saying that he would go out first thing in the morning and be seen with a sketchbook all day long until sunset. So a sort of obsessive interest. The interesting thing is when it translates to painting, he idealises a little more. So he's not quite as naturalistic as we'd expect by someone who studies outdoors.
Because to a large extent, the one that we're looking at, trees beside an ascending path, and that's exactly what it is, a group of trees on the right-hand side of the picture and a path coming down towards us into the foreground of the picture. It almost feels like a monochrome picture. It's that realistic.
Well, he uses white chalk so well to bring out that kind of highlight, and that's contrasting against the coloured paper, but it also creates a sense of depth. So even with something as unfinished looking as this particular drawing, it's extraordinary how much of a vista we feel, you know.
Yeah, and to get, because this is one of the comparisons I think that is made in the exhibition that we're talking about. The exhibition is the Gainsborough drawings in the National Gallery of Ireland. We'll tweet now at RTE Arena, the dunes near Haarlem. This is a Dutch painter,
exactly.
Jan Wijnands. And you're basically, the exhibition draws direct comparisons between what Gainsborough was doing in his drawings and paintings like this.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great things about the exhibition, because you get to see them side by side, which is, you know, always a great interest. So essentially, when he was a young man, one of the jobs he had was to work for an art dealer where he would touch up Dutch landscape paintings for sale, sometimes add in little figures. He also was known to have some exposure to Dutch works through various collections and auctions. But actually, East Anglia, where he's from, is quite near the Netherlands and has a very similar landscape. It's quite flat. So he seemed to have responded incredibly well to Dutch artists, where, you know, others like Turner, say, for example, loved Poussin and loved Claude Lorraine, whereas we have, you know, much more of an instinct towards the naturalism of Dutch art rather than the classicism of Italian art, is what Gainsborough is drawn to.
Let's finish up then by tweeting, this is Cornard Wood. This is a painting now. There is a drawing in there as well, but the painting, Cornard Wood, near Sudbury, Suffolk, 1748, and this is in the National Gallery of London. This is the realisation of the studies that the drawings are.
Absolutely. And it's an early large landscape painting for him as well. And it seems to have all of his ambition in it that didn't quite work out, because he never really made money from landscapes. He only made money from portraiture.
And is there something missing in that painting for you, you know, that explains why he didn't make money from something like this?
No, it simply comes down to the taste at the time for old masters in landscapes, and in particular, a sort of disregard for native painters anyway, which is why, you know, you have Hogarth and then later Joshua Reynolds really push towards making an environment that supports British artists. But the thing that I love about this painting, and one of the reasons to go in and see it, is that it has so many interesting little details. The small figures that exist within this landscape that aren't incidentally in the preparatory drawing, but they're in the finished painting, and they're all going about various different activities that would be common at the time. So it's fun to see it as a sort of window through time.
And this is an exhibition, I presume, it will give us a sense of that really popular painting, The Cottage Girl, more about the painter that we know and love from
exactly.
that.
Exactly, and who he really was, probably.
All right, Jess, thanks for that. That's Jessica Fahey speaking to us about Young Ginsberg, Rediscovered Landscape Drawings, currently on show at the National Gallery of Ireland. Admission free. I don't think we're back to normal now. You can just go in. You don't even have to book or anything like that.
Nope.
So check out the website for full details. nationalgallery.ie. Francis Ford Coppola's classic feature, The Godfather, turns 50 this year. The 1972 film and its sequel are revered as landmark cinema, and not just within the gangster genre. Themes of family, loyalty and, of course, betrayal play out with nuance, intelligence and heart. And that's before we even talk about the career-defining performances, notable quotable lines that have made it into common parlance, or the heads of animals deposited in beds as a chilling warning. To mark the anniversary, The Godfather of The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2 are back on the big screen for a limited release. Great opportunity to revisit not just a pair of Oscar-winning masterpieces, but two of the greatest films in the history of cinema. At the end of this month, the entire trilogy is being reissued in newly restored and remastered editions on Blu-ray. With us this evening to discuss the films, Stephen Benedict, lecturer at the National Film School. Let's start at the very beginning with Mario Puzo, the author of the novel itself. And here he is talking about how he came to write it.
It all began when the publisher of my second novel, The Fortunate Pilgrim, said, I wish you would have had more of the mafia in the book, it would have sold better. And I thought that was a good idea, so I wrote an outline for The Godfather and I showed it to him and he turned it down. And about eight other publishers turned it down. But an editor asked me to come up, and I just told him a few mafia stories that I knew. And they gave me an advance and told me to go ahead.
Mario Puzo there talking about the origins of The Godfather, tying into his earlier novel, The Fortunate Pilgrim. Only a small part of the novel, he's very keen to point out to us, addresses the mafia. Are there more connections between the two novels? It sounds so outrageous that he kind of couldn't get a publisher and the success that it became subsequently, Stephen.
Yeah, there's quite a few. The Fortunate Pilgrim is also about an Italian immigrant family, the Angeluzzi Corbos. And the mother of that family, Lucia Santa, she raises up to four children on her own in Hell's Kitchen during the Great Depression. And that is where and when Mario Puzo himself grew up. But here's the interesting thing. Sean, when the novel was reissued in 1996, Puzo declared that he had based Lucia Santa on his own mother Maria. But then when he's talking about The Godfather, whenever Don Corleone opened his mouth, it was Puzo's mother's voice that he heard. So in other words, Don Vito Corleone is based on Maria Puzo.
On his mother?
On his mother, yeah.
Just as a sidebar, did the mafia come anywhere near him after The Godfather?
No, I mean, some small-time mafiosis would come knocking on the door, offering him stories and offering Coppola stories. But the two of them were simply not interested in it at all, because really what they were talking about was something else other than just gangsters.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose we get this in the second clip that we have in the item, but the first clip that you've chosen from is very early clip here from...
This is the opening speech, opening lines of the film.
And it's a man coming to petition Don Corleone to avenge an attack on a young woman.
I believe in America. America has made my fortune. And I raised my daughter in the American fashion. I gave her freedom, but I taught her never to dishonor her family. She found a boyfriend, not an Italian. She went to the movies with him. She stayed out late. I didn't protest. 2 months ago, he took her for a drive with another boyfriend. They made her drink whiskey, and then they tried to take advantage of her.
And that's the actor Salvatore Corsito as the Undertaker Bonasera petitioning Don Corleone in The Godfather. An opening speech, and when we get that in the film, Stephen Bendick speaking to us about the 50th anniversary of The Godfather this evening, you don't know who the man is, who he's speaking to, or even where he is. I mean, it is a classic. You're going to have to stay watching or stay reading.
Yeah. Pay attention and wait. Yeah. And the brilliant thing is that in that very opening speech, 10 themes of the film are laid out. The opening line, "I believe in America." Now, that sounds like a prayer, but it's not a religious prayer. It's a prayer to a country, which means patriotism. And then he says, "America has made me my fortune." And that is a prayer to business. And then he says, "I raised my daughter in the American fashion, but I taught her never to dishonor her family." This is the voice of an Italian immigrant who knows full well the bigotry and prejudice that he met when he arrived in America. But he's also speaking of his daughter, and she's the victim of a savage assault, but the judge let their attackers go free. Now we have violence against women, which we'll be talking about hopefully in a minute. And at the end of the speech, the Undertaker says, "For justice, we must go to Don Corleone." So within 2 minutes, Sean, if I can just lift off the themes: religion, patriotism, business, patriarchy, family, misogyny, ethnicity. It sounds like a menu. Mm. The immigrant experience, prejudice and justice. And we haven't even talked about the sons yet.
Yeah, yeah. we haven't got into family. No. How long is it before we see Marlon Brando and Don Corleone?
Well, it's about,
when do we realise that it's he's
about
the
three
one?
And a half minutes in. Yeah. There's a reverse shot and all of a sudden we see this very, very aged Brando and you're saying, that's Marlon Brando. He was only 55 when he made the movie.
Wow. Yeah. But he's not the first. Well, that's not unusual, I suppose, that you wouldn't see the main character in the very opening shot, for sure. So, but the saga itself, you know, many people will talk about it being Shakespearean, power, succession. Mm. That's what we're dealing with. You could have King Lear with sons instead of daughters in the case
Hamlet
of Don
Corleone.
Yeah, Hamlet is in there, I suppose. You could. Is it too much to start talking about, you know, it's a piece of popular fiction. Is it too much to start talking about it as a Shakespearean piece?
No, I don't think so, because, you know, when Puzo wrote The Fortunate Pilgrim, the book was brilliantly received by the critics. So when he wrote The Godfather, he was boxing below his weight. And there are themes that he wove in there that Coppola recognised. And Coppola didn't want to make the movie at first. He thought it was incredibly crude, but he was an enormous amount of debt. This was an offer he couldn't refuse. So he accepted the offer and he went off and made the movie because he found Greek tragedy in there. Character's destiny, and that's Michael. Michael, at the beginning of the movie, wants nothing to do with the family criminal enterprise. And he says at the wedding, he says, "That's my family, Kay, that's not me." But he gives in. He surrenders his soul. And if you think about it, then
Michael, who's the character, of course, played by
Al Pacino. Yeah. And throughout the saga, you know, Michael gives up his soul claiming that he's there to protect his family. It's not the case at all. He gives it up because it's about profits. And if you think about, we mentioned business already, if you think about the TV series Succession, it's all about profits. They can do anything so long as profits are secured. You can kill, you can murder, you can maim, you can you can banish people from the family so long as it's profits.
People would have noticed that I mentioned The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2 quite a lot in the opening section of the introduction.
Yeah.
And then there was, oh yeah, and by the way, the trilogy will be on on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
How bad is The Godfather 3?
It's not. I think it's a case of just simply going to the well once too often. The thing is, we were talking about a tragedy. There's a true tragic personal level tragedy in the making of The Godfather Part 3, because in the third one, Michael is offered the chance at redemption in the form of paying the debts of the Vatican Bank, but it's too late because the sins of Michael are visited upon his innocent daughter, Mary. Now, in Coppola's real life, his eldest son, Joe, had grown up in his father's film sets, making the films with his father, and had an ambition to become a filmmaker himself. But in 1986, tragedy struck, because at the age of 22, Joe was killed in the most absolutely horrific boating accident. And 4 years later, Coppola makes The Godfather Part 3. And if you watch the ending of that film, you will see Coppola in the guise of Michael Corleone suffering that same heartbreak. And the added poignancy is that Mary Corleone in the film is played by Coppola's own daughter, Sophia.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned the whole idea of violence against women and misogyny as very important themes. And really what you're looking at, rather than taking clips here from the Godfather sequence or series of films itself, you're looking at the effect it has had
on
more modern and more recent manifestations of the gangster movie and basically of male-female relationships. We're going to play a compilation. You can have fun now at home. See how many of these voices you recognise, how many characters you recognise.
I know there are women like my best friends who would have gotten out of there the minute their boyfriend gave them a gun to hide. But I didn't. I gotta admit the truth. It turned me on.
It's the thing that no one tells you about evil. They make it seem like there are two clearly marked paths with flashing signs pointing out each way. Sin, redemption.
We hardly talk. He's involved in doings I can't bear to think about. He blames me. I blame him. And I feel like the life is being pressed out of me.
I know now that it's over. I knew it then. There would be no way, Michael, no way you could ever forgive me. Not with this Sicilian thing that's been going on for 2,000 years.
My husband. I think he has committed horrible acts. I'm so ashamed. Allowing my children, oh my God, my sweet children, to be a part of it. Because I wanted things for them. I wanted a better life. Wanted money in my hands. Money to buy anything I ever wanted.
All right, so how many did you get? The very final one that we heard there, Stephen Benedict, was Eddie Falco as Carmela Soprano in The Sopranos. Let's go back to the very first one that we heard. The Godfather music underneath is Touch of Genius, just so that we know that we're comparing
yeah,
it to that.
More, you know, Rocha, yeah, we heard Laura Linney in Orzacs.
Lorraine Bracco as yeah. Karen Hill. No, it was the very first one was Lorraine Bracco, was it?
No, it was Laura Linney.
Oh, Laura Linney. And then it was Lorraine Bracco in Goodfellas. Wonderful Irish accent in the next
Kelly
one.
Kelly MacDonald playing Margaret Schroeder
in
Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire.
Then we hear Kay played by Diane Keaton in
Godfather Part 2. So hearing all of those women speaking and the various ways in which violence is or isn't dealt with and the violence of their husbands, how does The Godfather factor or manage with all of that?
Well, I think the movie depicts misogyny. I don't think the films are misogynist in themselves. And I think the most important thing to note is that it's opened up a new avenue and a new arena in which gangsters can explore that. And if we just finish off on Carmela, I think its most important thing there is that she knows precisely what Tony does. And she deludes herself because of the material comforts that it offers and provides. And I think that's so reflective of society in general, Sean, because I think of the financial deals struck by businesses with Putin's Russia, all in the name of profits. Mm. And if you permit me from misquoting St. Matthew's gospel, for what does it profit a man if he gains great wealth, but does so by trading with a savage gangster? And that's the reality of The Godfather.
All right. Well, The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2, unlimited release in Irish cinemas at the moment. If you want The Godfather Part 3, you can get the Blu-ray for yourself. Stephen Benedict speaking to us this evening.